So this morning's sermon, we're looking at Genesis chapter 4 this morning. And Genesis chapter 4 is a story about what happens when we raise ourselves up above other people. And not raising ourselves up in a good way, but when we raise ourselves up in that self-important way, in that way where we put ourselves above others so that our needs actually come before everyone else's. And we put ourselves high in this place. And the story of Genesis is kind of shocking because it says that this thing that all of us do, because let's be honest, all of us have done that. We've all probably done that in the past week in our families. We've put our needs before others. But Genesis is answering, it's trying to answer these big questions of life. And Lawrence raised a question a few weeks ago. How can people actually be as evil as to kill one another? How can humans who were created in the image of God end up having wars against each other? And Genesis 4 is trying to start answering that question. And the shocking thing that it suggests is that this thing that is in us that makes us want to raise ourselves up above everyone else, that this is actually at the root of this human of tendency to hurt one another. And actually, it suggests, I'm not even making this up, it says that this is at the root of war as well. So that's what we're going to look at today. And I'm going to read the story now. There is good news in this story, I will say that, so hang on, because first we have to walk through what is kind of a dark story, but there is incredible hope in it. So I'm going to read the story, and I want you to listen for all of the places where someone in the story tries to raise themselves up, thinks of themselves as more important than others in the story. But I also want you to pay attention to how God is acting in this story, how God is counteracting this. All right, so I'm going to read Genesis chapter 4. I'm reading from the ESV, so if you have the option on your device to turn to that translation, it'll be a little bit easier, but feel free just to listen as well. Now Adam knew his wife Eve. Remember, this is taking place just after Adam and Eve were ushered out of the garden. So they have eaten from the fruit, and now they're outside the garden. So Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, her first child, saying, "I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord." And again, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain, a worker of the ground. And in the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of fruit of the ground. And Abel also brought the firstborn of his flock and their fat portions. And the Lord had regard, the Lord liked Abel's offering. But for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. He wasn't happy. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted?" Another way to translate this is, "Will you not be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door, and its desire is contrary to you. Its desire is to have you, but you must rule over it." Cain spoke to his brother Abel. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and he killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And when you work the ground, it shall no longer yield you to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on earth." And Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." And then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." Remember, seven has this sense of completeness. "So I'll completely take care of them." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who found him should attack him. And then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And then Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And when he built a city, he called the name of the city after his son Enoch. And to Enoch was born Arad, and Arad fathered Mahujael, and Mahujael fathered Methusael, and Methusael fathered Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. And the name of one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal, and he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. Fun fact. And his brother was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who played the lyre or stringed instruments and pipes. Another fun fact in Genesis 4. And Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain, and he was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron, perhaps ushering in the bronze or iron age. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naama. Now Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You, wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, and a young man for striking me. So if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, let Lamech's be 77-fold. And Adam knew his wife again. And she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. And to Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And at that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. It's an interesting story. There's a lot in here. We often think that this story, Genesis chapter 4, is a story about two people, Cain and Abel, right? They're the famous ones. There's works of music and art and amazing things all throughout history talking about Cain and Abel, but actually this story is about three people. It's about Eve, it's about Cain, and it's about Lamech. Now, we know who Eve is, right? She's the first woman created, the mother of all living. She's Cain's mom. And we know who Cain is. He's the guy, the really lovely guy who kills his little brother because he gets mad. And Lamech, that might not be as familiar to us. Lamech is the guy who shows up towards the end of this story. And he is, let's see if I can get this right, he is Adam's great-great-great-great-grandson. He is the seventh generation in Adam's family. Now remember, again, the number seven, which keeps popping up in these stories, it means fullness or completeness. So Lamech's generation represents kind of like the fullness of humanity. They're the seventh generation on earth. They represent sort of the epitome of what humanity and humanity's legacy on earth. So if David Attenborough was doing sort of a human legacy, what is the legacy of humanity on earth? And he asked this question back in the ancient world, they would say, oh, look at Lamech's generation. That's the generation that sort of shows what humans have become. So we're going to look at these three stories this morning and how they intertwine, because they intertwine in sort of in a crazy and dangerous way. But they also show throughout these stories, there's a thread of grace that weaves through them as well. So listen for that. So let's begin with the story of Eve. So Adam and Eve, we find at the beginning of chapter 4, are surprisingly still kind of living the dream. Because remember, in chapter 3, they had it really good, and then they ate the fruit, and God said, because you have made this choice to define good and evil for yourselves, now you are going to be living under a curse. And it's going to lead to death. It will lead to death. So we're kind of surprised at the beginning of chapter 4 to find Adam and Eve aren't dead. They're actually very much alive, and the world is still operating under God's blessing. Last week, Paul talked about grace outrunning this avalanche of sin. So Adam and Eve, when they ate the fruit, sort of unleashed this avalanche of sin. But always a few steps ahead is God's grace running ahead and making provision. And so we see at the beginning of chapter 4 this incredible grace of God. So Adam and Eve are outside the garden, but they're still together. They are having children. And God is still, we find out in this chapter, God's still walking with them and talking with them like he did in the garden. And their children are learning how to be stewards of the earth. They've become shepherds and farmers, and they're taking care of this world that God created for them. And at the end of chapter 3, Adam does an interesting thing. He names his wife Eve, which means the mother of all things that are living, all things living. And so Eve has this child, the first birth on earth happens. And Eve says an interesting thing. She says, I have brought forth a man, not a baby, a man, a human. It must have been an amazing moment, the first birth. I mean, that would be an incredible thing. And she says, I've brought forth a human. And we don't really know how to translate. No one knows how to translate what comes next. Some people say, she said, I have brought forth a human, like God. Others say, she said, I have brought forth a human, God. Which doesn't make a lot of sense, but some think maybe she said that. And others think she means, I have brought forth a human, and God has helped me. But whatever it is that she says, there's a sense of pride. There's a sense of boasting. Look what I have done. And perhaps Eve is feeling like, maybe eating that fruit wasn't such a bad idea after all. Or things are still pretty good. And look, I have now created a human. I am like God. So she names him Cain, which means brought forth, which is interesting. She names him almost out of her own boasting. Cain, the one that I have created, I have brought forth. And then she has a second son, which is almost a footnote. She names him Abel. And Abel means wind or breeze. It has the sense of meaning nothingness. How brutal is that? Anyone hear a second child? Imagine you get named, nothingness. Eve knows what it's like to be the first. She's the first woman, the first one to give birth, and she celebrates this and passes on this pride of firstness into her children. She names Cain, she honors him, and then she calls her second one, who cares? He's the second. It's nothingness. So we need to pause Eve's story here because the Bible actually pauses it here, and we don't pick it up until the very end of chapter 4. So now we move on to Cain's story, and we can go to the next slide. Cain, the firstborn. How many here are the firstborn in their family, the oldest? All right, I am too. There's a bunch of us. How many of you are the firstborn male in your family? Okay, so all of you guys would have had a very important role in your family in the ancient Near East. You may still have this in your family, depending on your family culture. But you got something called a birthright if you were the firstborn male, which means that when your father was dividing up his land at the end of his life, you got a double portion of the land. So you got twice as much as your siblings did. Pretty nice. But you also, because you got this extra responsibility, you also had authority in your family over your other siblings. Not, like, you got to boss them around, but it was also to protect them and to care for them. And there was this great sense of responsibility. So not only did you get extra stuff, but you also had to care for your mom and your unmarried sisters until you or they died. Like, that was your responsibility. And you had to make sure that your little brothers grew up to be responsible, good guys. So there was responsibility. So this is Cain's job. Cain is born into this. He is the firstborn, and not just the firstborn, but he's like the firstborn in creation. And Eve celebrates this. He has special status in his mom's eyes. But the problem in our story arises when Cain discovers he doesn't have special status in God's eyes. It must have been a shocker to him. Both his brother, named Nothingness, Wisp of the Wind, and him offer sacrifices to God, which was the right thing to do. And we don't know why, but God saw value in Abel's sacrifice. And for whatever reason, he saw that Cain's attitude in sacrifice was not right. And he gave him an attitude check. And he said, hey, Cain, what's this? And Cain was furious. Absolutely furious, probably because he had this huge sense of self. He had stepped himself up on the chair, just like we saw here. And when you step up on the chair, as we saw, even the winner can pull the other guy off really, really easily. We're vulnerable when we're lifted up, when we lift ourselves up. And so Cain was vulnerable, and he blew up when God said, this isn't right. And God comes to him in graciousness, and he says, Cain, I know you're really angry. I know that this is hard for you, because you know how you feel so important. But he's like, if you do what is right, it's like, I'll lift you up. He says, you will be lifted up. God will lift him up. You don't have to do that on your own. But if you don't, if you continue to get up on that chair, sin, God says, is crouching like an animal, and it wants you. It wants to take you down, and it will. But you must, the word here, the sense of it is, you will defeat it. You can defeat it. Well, Cain ignores this completely. He's so mad that he ignores it. And he lures his brother Abel into the field, and he kills him. And God comes to Cain, and he says, where's Abel? God knows, right? He already knows, but he wants to talk to Cain about it. And Abel says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Now, have we heard this word keeper before in the story? It depends on what translation you're reading, but the same word in Hebrew, it shows up earlier in Genesis. And it shows up in the charge that God gives to humans. So he gives them kind of this twofold charge. He says, you are to be like rulers, like kings and queens of the earth. He says, you're to exercise your rule like a servant, a keeper. So you're supposed to be like these servant kings who use their power actually to serve others. And the word, it's the same word as keeper. So yes, Cain was his brother's keeper. Not just his brother's keeper, but also keeper of creation in the land. Am I my brother's keeper, he says. Cain chucks out the servant part of God's charge, and he holds on to the king part. He says, I am a ruler, but I am not a servant. And we get murder, we get death that comes out of this. To punish him, God sends him far away, which is an act of grace in itself. Far away where he can't harm other people, far away where maybe he will actually live, and he does live. In the Old Testament, if you murdered someone in cold blood, like you meant to and you murdered them, the cost was your own life. But right at the beginning, God says, actually, that's not my ideal. You've murdered someone, but I'm going to spare you. And so he sends him away. And Cain says, this is too much to bear because I'm going to be away from your presence. But is Cain really away from God's presence? Not actually. We see God's presence continue in his life. But Cain, setting himself up on the top of the chair as the king, has no room for another king in his life. And so even though God is there, he has blocked him out. And it will feel for the rest of his life like he's far, far away from God, because he is the only king. So one of the reasons we know that God is still present in Cain's life is because after his exile, we see God's grace at work. So somehow, we don't know how, God provides a wife for Cain. And Cain's descendants go on to make this city, the first city. And many years down the road, Cain's great-great-great-grandson is born, and his name is Lamech. And so now we'll go to Lamech's story. So what can we say about the kind of guy that Lamech is? So here's something that will hopefully give you a bit of a picture. Up until this point, it was customary for one man, even a murderer like Cain, to take one wife for himself, because that's how God set it up. That was the pattern, and so up until this point, one man marries one wife. But for Lamech, who's probably now king of the city that Cain established many years ago, Lamech wasn't satisfied with just one woman, and so he takes two. It's the first instance in the Bible where someone marries two wives. He's a really, really great guy. And guess what their names are? So the first one's named Ada, which means ornament. Yeah. And the second one is named Zillah, which means shadow. And Jewish tradition says that Abel married Ada for her good looks, to be an ornament, and he married Zillah to have children for him, to be a servant, essentially. So you're getting a good picture from this of the kind of guy that Lamech is. He's not the nicest guy. And it unfortunately gets worse. In the story, he calls his wives to him, his wives who don't get to say anything in the story. He does all the talking. He says, "Listen to me. I have killed a man. Actually, I've killed a boy, a young man, for injuring me. And if God said that he would protect my great-great-great-grandfather Cain, who was a murderer, well, then I think God should protect me even more, because I'm even greater than Cain. Look at this city now, this throne that I sit on." And so scholars point out that the world now in the story is filling up with people. And so when Cain says, God will avenge me 77 times, he's referring to war between possibly cities, between people groups. There will be lots of people fighting. And he's boasting about it, and he's boasting and saying, God's on my side. If a war starts because of what I've done, God is going to be on my side, and he's going to help me win. Why? Because I'm the king of the city. Again, we find someone who has stepped up on the chair, who has raised themselves up above others. And Lamech is the seventh generation after Adam. And so in this story, we see one choice for one couple to raise themselves up, turning into this death spiral until what epitomizes humans on earth is war and vengeance and treating other humans, namely women in this story, like property. So Eve boasted. She boasted, "I have gotten a man." She stepped up onto the chair. She raised herself up above even future generations and said, "Look at me. I have created like God." But not a big deal, right? I mean, there are those moments we do things and we're like, "Hey, look at what we did." But this had a terrible effect on the next generation. And so Cain inherits this inflated sense of importance being the first. So inflated, and he gets himself so high on that chair that sin, which is trying to take him down, easily pulls him down. And he kills his brother, the first murder in creation. And we don't know what Cain's sons were like, the ones that would go on to sit on this chair in the city that he built for himself. But we know that by the time it gets to Lamech, things are really bad. And Lamech puts himself on this chair so high above others that he is treating women like property and slaves. He's boasting about killing kids and boasting that God, who is really just another slave to him, will support him in war. This is just what God said would happen. That the minute Adam and Eve raised themselves up, because what did they do? They tried to raise themselves up above God. They said, "We can do a better job than God can of defining good and evil." And God said, "Okay, but it will lead to death." And this is what we see unraveling in this story. It's kind of scary, isn't it? Because all of us, we know that we have that same thing in us. And we do it all the time, where we put ourselves in front of others. We put ourselves at the center, or another way of looking is we raise ourselves up. We step up on our own chairs. Maybe it's when you get home from school and you're starving and you walk in the door and you say, "Mom and Dad, feed me," before you've even asked how they're doing or what their day is. We've done that. We've all done that. Or going home from work and your day's been crazy and you get there and you just unload it on your spouse or your roommate before asking how they are. Why? Because your needs take priority, and you just feel like what's going on in your world is so important. We all have this urge in us to step up on the chair and put ourselves first. Desmond Tutu, who we can go to the next slide, is the former Archbishop of the Church in South Africa. He's the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and probably one of the greatest activists for peace and reconciliation of our time. And he lived through what was probably a glimpse of hell on earth. He lived and served during apartheid, which it happened in South Africa when the group of white South Africans in power elevated themselves high in that society and oppressed, severely oppressed, the black South Africans. When we lift ourselves up to get on that chair, even if it's just little, in order to do that, we have to kind of press others down. And this pressing down is called oppression. And so this happened on a large scale in South Africa, where one group lifted themselves up because of their skin color and their heritage, and they pressed the others down. And Nelson Mandela served as a pastor and church leader in this time, and he's written widely about reconciliation, about forgiveness. Desmond Tutu. He worked alongside Nelson Mandela to bring peace into this horrible chapter in South Africa's history. And he said, when we oppress others, we end up oppressing ourselves. All of our humanity is dependent on recognizing the humanity in others. And he goes on to explain, when you're born, you need other humans to become a human. So if you're born and you're just left to grow up in isolation, terrible things happen. You don't fully form. We are dependent on other humans to form into a human. This is part of being made in the image of God, is to be made in relationship with others. And so the minute that we step up on our chair and put our own needs above others and push others down, we begin to break something that's natural in us. And we put ourselves in an extremely vulnerable place. But there is hope in this story. Desmond Tutu said that he always believed in his heart, even at the worst, the darkest hours during apartheid, he believed that it would eventually crumble and fall because it was based on this thing that isn't natural to humans. This hate, this sort of elevating one above the other, and he knew from stories like this, which informed his own life, that when you put yourself above others, you're extremely vulnerable, and eventually sin is going to take you down. And that at our hearts, we were created for relationship. We were created to love one another. And so he believed that eventually this would right the wrongs. And we have seen in our own lifetime, we've seen that happen in South Africa. We've seen that happen in Rwanda, many places in the world. There's hope. There's hope for us. So I haven't finished Eve's story yet. Eve's story picks up again at the very end of chapter 4. And God brings them back into the story, even though we've just been talking about like 7 generations down the road. Suddenly we go back and we focus on Adam and Eve. And it says that God gave them another baby. And this time Eve says something different. Again, we hear her voice. She makes an exclamation. But instead of beginning with I have gotten a man, she begins with God. God. Instead of saying, I have acquired a human, she says, God has given me another child. A little difference, but a huge difference. And she names this child Seth. It's the third child now. And Seth means granted or given. What a difference from Cain's birth story, hey? Where she names him acquired, the one that I have acquired, I have helped create. And you can almost hear the sadness in her voice as she says, here is another child, this one I have been granted, in place of Abel, since Cain killed him. She names what happened in history. And it's the first time in this whole story that Abel's name has been spoken by another human being other than God. Well, that by a human, full stop. Eve, Abel's mom, who named him Nothingness, finally speaks his name. And he is remembered in the story. And it's also the first time that Cain's deed is named by someone else. Cain, who was the firstborn, the one she was so proud of, Eve names that he killed Abel. Eve suffered a lot from the beginning of chapter 4 to the end of chapter 4 as she watched her choices bear horrible fruit. And I think, what a painful lesson for Eve to learn. But the grace in this story is that she learns it. Just like Eve's death sent a spiral, or Eve's choice sent a spiral of death in motion that sort of blows up in Lamech's generation, her change of heart and attitude now leads to a growth spurt of life. Life begins to flare up. At the very end of chapter 4, you can look and read it yourself. It says, "And at that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord." Amazing. In other words, people began to step down off of their thrones that they'd raised themselves up on and allow God to be on that throne, take on the servant part of their role. Every time we put someone else's needs above our own, every time we serve others and allow them to be valued and important for who we are, who they are, we unleash this powerful force of good into the world, one that is actually stronger than this force of sin and death and war. Eve didn't do this on her own. We know how hard it is not to put ourselves in front of others. It's a daily battle. And the great hope in this story is that Eve had help. In fact, all of them had help. Every single person in this story, God reaches out to, and you can imagine them having stood up on their chair, and God, it's like God is standing beside each one of them, and he's offering his hand saying, "I'm going to help you down where you're going to be a lot firmer." And Cain is probably the most dramatic one. So Cain, who's furious because God doesn't see him as the most important person in the entire universe, is met by God right at the beginning of the story. And God says, "Cain, don't you know that if you do what is right, you will be lifted up? It will be lifted up. Your face will be lifted up. I will lift you up." And doing what is right is often talked about as righteousness in the Old Testament. And what it means is being in right relationship. Being in right relationship means stepping off of our high chairs or high horses and allowing God to be on that chair, which is really a throne that we've set up for ourselves, isn't it? And allowing God to be on that throne because he's the only one that's good at it. He's the only one that can sit on that throne and ensure that life goes out into the world instead of death. Because when God is on the throne, he doesn't lord his power over us. He shows us what it means to be a servant king. He gets down low. And the most dramatic example of this is when God, who is on his throne, which is totally okay for him to be on, gets off and stands down on the ground with us in the person of Jesus Christ, fully God and fully human, and shows us what it means to serve one another. He dies on behalf of the oppressed, on behalf of the sinful, even murderers like Cain, in order that we might be lifted up. When Jesus, when Jesus did this, he began a pattern, a process even, of life growing up, even from the darkest places in our world. And every time that we put someone else, that we follow his example by putting someone else in front of us, we participate in that life that is going out into the world. And our symbol of that as Christians, if you look back, is the cross, which is where Christ died, which is where this life, which is a dark symbol of torture, but also the symbol now of where we see life springing up. I want you to think back on this past week. Just take a moment to reflect. When have you stepped up onto the chair, put your needs above others, put yourself in front of others? And you're not alone. Every single one of us in this room has done it. And I want you to imagine, maybe even just pick one moment, And imagine that God is standing there next to you on your chair saying, hey, come on down. Come down. If he can reach his hand out to Lamech, I wish we had time to go through each person in this story to discover how God invites them to a different possibility, invites them to step down off the chair. I'll leave that to you to study on your own. But if God can do that, even for guys like Lamech, with warlords who are boasting and have somehow twisted his name and saying, God is actually supporting this war, me. If he can do that for Lamech, he can do that for us. God reaches out his hand to each of us to help us to step down so that we can make him king. And the most incredible thing happens when we do that. We find that we're not suddenly now these lowly, like, I don't know, servants standing on the ground, but he calls us kings and queens with him. He invites us into his family, and he names us his own children and shows us how to be servant kings and queens. I'm going to call up our communion servers because we're going to do communion today. So if you're serving communion, come on up. Communion is a symbol of God's servant king nature. It's a thing that we do that reminds us that God stepped down off of his throne, which was rightfully his. He didn't have to, but he did step down to be with us, that he gives himself to us to make us strong. He feeds us with himself to nourish us, to lift us up, so we don't have to lift ourselves up. Communion is also a symbol of our unity as a family of God. We all eat from the same loaf of bread, and we drink from the same cup. And it reminds us, that thing that Desmond Tutu was talking about, that we were created in the image of God to be in relationship, that we can't be human on our own. Our humanity is dependent on recognizing each the humanity in the other. And so when we take communion, we declare that. We recognize that we're in this together. And the only way we're in it together is because Christ enabled us to be. He stepped down and showed us how.